Hi there, House Culture listener. If you enjoy this episode or have enjoyed listening to other episodes in our series, please support and donate to us through the Acast supporter feature. All donations will help us create the content that you love listening to. You can decide how much you give and there's no regular commitment. So it could be a one-off and every now and then or once every time you listen. It's up to you. Click on the supporter link that you can find in the episode or show description, and with Google or Apple Pay, it will take you less than 30 seconds to make your payment.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Danny Rampling, and you're listening to the House Culture Podcast.
House Culture.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the House Culture Podcast, hosted by me, the managing editor at House Culture, Matt Rouse. As ever, I hope you're all managing to stay safe and sane. With things changing back and forth so rapidly at the moment, I hope we can cure some of that frustration you might be having by delivering some good vibes from the club directly into your lockdown life at home. If you're not familiar with House Culture and what we stand for, we are a collective of house music fans who have come together through our mutual love of the beat to celebrate the spirit of house music. Instagram is our home at houseculturenet. That's where you can get up close and personal with us and like-minded individuals from across the world. And if you haven't been listening to our podcast series, where have you been? This second season has been our biggest yet, featuring interviews with legends such as Fatboy Slim, Tall Paul, Ashley Beadle, and the Ibethan icon and creative director at Pike's Hotel, Dawn Hindle. And now I'm absolutely thrilled to be able to say that this episode is another addition to that pantheon of legends, as I caught up with one of the founding fathers of the house music scene, Danny Rampling. It's one of the first ones we've recorded during lockdown, so we have a lot to talk about, including his first impressions of Ibiza on that fateful trip back in 1987.
It was a complete revelation, the way Alfredo weaved many textures of music together, from soul, funk, boogie, to hip-hop, to jazz, to Latin, to techno, to house, disco. Just such an eclectic mix of music, which we termed Balearic Beats. I returned and created a club called Shum.
The impact that his club night Shum had on the partygoers of that era.
It was also new, also fresh. It brought so many different people together. We created unity. It was a collective consciousness that swept through the UK and across the world for that matter.
How his passion for music still burns inside him.
I'm immensely grateful that 30 odd years I'm here, still appreciated and still doing what I love. And that's not to be taken for granted for 1 minute, because when it is taken away, and I stepped away for 2 years, you never know what you've got until it's gone. Kind of that old saying. That is so true.
And the importance of us all gathering as one on the dance floor.
We all need to dance. It's important to dance to release those positive, good endorphins. It's a primal need of most human beings, whatever age you are, to dance.
So, are you ready? Get yourself set for a sermon from one of the house music gods. This is Danny Rampling.
Culture.
Hi Danny, thanks for finding the time to sit down with us amongst all of the COVID campaigning you've been doing. It's massively appreciated. You are one of the originators of the house music scene in the UK and played a huge part in getting it to where it is today. We always want to start at the beginning of that journey and find out, can you talk to us about when you first discovered music growing up, and how did you understand the feelings that it gave you?
First and foremost, welcome. How did I first fall in love with music and my earliest musical memories? I fell in love with music through the radio. My mother played the radio, had the radio on, should I say, in the house all throughout the day. So that's where my music journey began, being fascinated how radio broadcast music and speech over the airwaves, which became an obsession and fascination with radio.
What was the type of music that was being played and what stations were being listened to?
Well, pop music. Yeah. I was a kid, so like 7, 8 years old, BBC Radio 1. And that was seemed to be the main station at the time, the BBC, really. There wasn't the wealth of stations there is now. So, nevertheless, that really was where the passion for music began, and also collecting records at a very young age from listening to the radio. I then started collecting music very early on, and I'd get record tokens and spend at Christmas and birthdays and spend those record tokens on 7-inch singles, and built up a collection. So I wanted to be a DJ very early on in my life, listening to radio and collecting music. I didn't know how, when and where, but that seed was planted. I really wanted to be on the radio, and many years later, I did become a leading DJ on BBC Radio 1 on a primetime show there. I stayed there for over 7 years on a Saturday night with the Love Groove Dance Party.
So you had kind of a great record collection. Were you like, from other DJs that we've interviewed, they'd obviously be collectors and they would have this collection. They would be the go-to guy for like turn up at the party with their records. Was that what you were doing from a young age as well? Or was it all just kind of playing?
Yeah, not from a very young age. I just collected all sorts of music. The first music I heard was rock and roll, Tamla Motown, pop music. Glam rock, all those things. It's a long while ago. That's playing at parties took a long time to achieve that, and that was into my 20s. Yeah. That didn't happen in my teenage years, but you know what we know and love today, the landscape was very, very different back then. There wasn't the opportunities, there wasn't the breaks, and there wasn't the scene like we have today.
So your kind of first teenage experiences going out to nightclubs and things like that, what kind of music were you into during that period?
In the 70s, disco was that was the sound, disco, reggae. But I used to attempt to get into a nightclub at about 15 years old. I think I only got in there once or twice, probably when the doorman was in a better mood and was focused on something else. But that was in Crystal Palace Hotel, and there used to be a DJ there that used to play American imports, and really kind of alongside the radio with DJs like Greg Edwards and Robbie Vincent, who were playing that style of music on the radio that I used to listen to, and David Rodigan. Yeah.
And did you kind of see these guys behind the decks or whatever, like performing and, you know, bringing this music to the masses? Was that an inspiration then, or like you say, did it come later on?
Yeah, it was an inspiration to go out and buy music in American import music. I'd listen to their radio shows like many kids and then go out and buy that music. But half the time, that the music was really exclusive. They get it from producers in New York, which is exactly what I did some years later. And you'd have to wait, and the search for an import single or album sometimes would take a bit of time, but it was all part of the thrill and the chase of finding that particular piece of music. And then all of a sudden, the record store would be full of a particular American import record. Then it gets signed to a UK label. So it was a great time, particularly for record shops. And on the radio, the choice of dance music on the radio was very, very limited back then. Now there's everything, internet, DAB. The choice is so extensive and broad right now in the present.
Yeah. And so how are you discovering, you know, obviously it's import stuff. It's really obviously no Shazam or anything back then. How were you discovering what these tracks were called? Were you going to record shops and singing a bit of the vocal hook, or taking a pad and a pen out and badgering the DJs? How was that discovery happening?
Of course, there was a bit of train spotting involved, as there is with everyone who's a vinyl collector or a music collector. So, yeah, at the club, I'd ask what records were. And radio was the main source, really, at that time, to hear new music and then make notes of it and then go and buy certain records in the stores in London, in Groove Records, one particular record store, which was a great record store in Soho. So, yeah, it was radio and club, yes. So, yeah, standing there in one's anorak with a notepad and pen, taking down the details. But actually, I'm the world's worst train spotter. I'm more visual. And the thing is with, you know, kind of labels, catalogue numbers, some people were very meticulous and detailed in their knowledge of certain labels, and they know the catalogue number, the release date, and the producer, the engineer, the backing singers, the vocalist, all these things combined. But they're more analytical, and I'm one of the visual crowd of record buyers. Who, you know, record sleeves, you'd know what that was immediately, particularly when you're in a dark club and looking at vinyl when I was playing vinyl and putting fluorescent stickers on the covers to identify what they were in the dark.
Yeah, I totally get that. I've no memory for names or anything like that. It's more around like what the label looked like or what the picture on the sleeve looked like to kind of try and dig those records out. I mean, you mentioned there like fluorescent labels and things like that on the sleeves. Was that how you kind of catalogued like different styles and like how much energy tracks had, or was it just a...
I'll get one for you. Hold on. I just found this recently. You'll find this amusing. It's covered up and it's Italian rare record. It took me a year to find it. So, yes, this took 1 year to find for me. That must have hacked a few people off who were poking their head over the DJ booth. I can't remember what this track is actually called. I can't even remember what it's called. It could be Alexandra Robotnik, I have a feeling. It looks like that label. Mm. Yeah, I used to go to Italy and buy records. And broke a lot of those records. I'd spend much time and money hunting through warehouses and Italian record stores, and then bring back the tracks and play them at Shume and cover them up. And that really was a kind of parallel what was going on with the Northern Soul scene, which I wasn't part of the Northern Soul DJ circuit, and I hadn't been to the Wigan Casino or any of those clubs. But I guess I'd read about it somewhere and decided to cover them up. But what that did... it created this hunger for particular tracks, and people would be clambering to find out what they were. And then after a couple of months, I'd take the stickers off, and people would be guessing. There was no Shazam then. Mm. So the odd person would know what the track was, and then that would open up a whole gateway to people being able to get the track, and the record importers would find out what those tracks were and then import them from Italy. So it was great, but it was all part of the fun of it. It was a thrill to chase pieces of music, which still goes on today with limited vinyl, which is healthy. It's a great thing, that scarcity of music and the unknown, and chasing a piece of music. There are some tracks that take years to find, and then those gold nuggets are found or purchased and treasured. I think, you know, that approach, it really made people value music more as well. Now I think, you know, digitally a lot of music is so transient and so turn the page after a couple of plays and it's on to the next track. Whereas back then there was a lot more longevity with music and breaking records through that approach.
Yeah, totally. And you know, it's any bit of vinyl or that you'd be purchasing, like you say, you'd either be going to Italy to buy it or you'd be in a record shop, and you would have that specificity of memory of buying that one record. I was in that record shop and I was talking to this guy, and it's all about that experience, and that's kind of been lost a little bit in the digital experience, like you say.
Yeah, unfortunately it has, but there are some great record stores that have re-emerged in recent times. and the sales of vinyl are increasing, and the renaissance of vinyl is increasing year on year. So there is a shift towards vinyl collectors, and the passion for vinyl, particularly with the limited copies of productions that are solely exclusive to vinyl. And Andrew Weddle was a big purveyor of vinyl only, and he'd had his own artwork that would accompany the vinyl collections. He's sadly missed. He was a great friend.
Yeah.
Justin Robertson does that also. And a lot of producers do now. So just pressing 250, 500 copies, and that's it of that particular track, which creates a rare groove, which Norman Jay was the figurehead in that scene and movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to have it on vinyl now is seen as, you know, the ultimate. You are up there in terms of the DJ league to have something on vinyl now rather than just like just downloading it and getting a copy of it. It might be the same thing, but if you've got the physical copy of it, that's seen as real currency.
And Sven Vatt, he's, you know, kind of the leading DJ in Germany, a legend. He still plays vinyl-only sets. That's his approach. He hasn't gone down the digital route.
Mm.
But I find also, what I do find frustrating is some of those vinyl tracks, you know, you want them, and I don't play vinyl out in clubs anymore. So, and you can't find them digitally. So it's quite frustrating in that respect.
Yeah, or you've got it on vinyl, but you just want to extend that little section to give yourself a good intro or outro. And actually, no, you've just got to be creative with how it's originally pressed. And, you know, those boundaries often create the best kind of creativity, I think.
Yeah.
Rather than having all options available to you all the time. I mean, so, you know, you're obviously collecting vinyl, and I want to kind of lead up to that fateful Ibiza trip, obviously, in 87. You know, were you into a scene beforehand that took you to Ibiza, or was it just an offhand thing that, like, that sounds like a good place to go? Or how did it all kind of come about?
I mean, it's a lifetime ago, Matt, really. It's so long ago. It's so long ago, but the memories are like yesterday. And
great.
I'll treasure them forevermore, as most people will who were part of that early scene and out there in Ibiza. Before Ibiza, I was into the soul scene, Case the Weekenders, and Nicky Holloway. I was his assistant, where I learned a lot about DJing. And he was a leading London promoter at the time and in the Southeast. And he did lots of events, lots of warehouse parties and parties at London Zoo and the Science Museum. You name it, he did a party there, Nicky, at the time. So I learned a lot from Nicky.
Yeah,
but that was the scene I was on, and we'd go to Dirtbox warehouse parties and Shake and Finger Pop Meltdown parties with Jonathan Moore and Matt Black, who later became Cold Cuts. They used to hold parties on the river, on the south side of the river, when the London development hadn't even began then at that point in the 80s. So it was lots of rundown warehouses, and that was an epicentre of warehouse parties down there on the South Bank in SE1, in Rotherhithe, and Spice warehouses.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big place to go to warehouse parties at that time. So that was really the background before going to Ibiza. And I read a feature by Cheryl Garrett in The Face. It was only a small feature about this DJ Alfredo playing in Amnesia in the open air and after hours club. And that was it, really. I came back from America, where I've been for a year, and it was Paul Oakenfold's birthday. So we all took a flight over to Ibiza in August of that year in 87.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a complete revelation. You know, the way Alfredo weaved many textures of music together, from soul, funk, boogie, to hip hop, to jazz, to Latin, to techno, to house, disco. Just such an eclectic mix of music, which we termed Balearic beats, particularly the indie stuff that he used to play, and industrial sounds as well. So it was a real melting pot of music, but he had his own particular style of playing that music and making it all work together, which was really impressive, and it inspired us all, just the same way as Larry Levan and Frankie Knuckles inspired a generation of DJs in America, and Ron Hardy at the warehouse in Chicago back then in the late 70s and 80s, more so the 80s. And that's really, what, for me personally, that's where the stage was set. I'd been aspiring to get onto the club circuit, but as I said earlier, it really was quite a closed shop. Even though I was on Kiss FM, the pirate station at the time, I hadn't found my true identity musically. I was playing independent soul music, hip hop, black music, you know, all kinds of stuff, Prelude and garage sounds. But it was that trip which really solidified everything for my own vision of what I wanted to achieve. And it just came together there. It was a revelation for all of us. And I returned and created a club called Shoom in a basement in Frowell Street, SE1 in London, which was in a gym. It was a gym during the week. At the weekend, push all the gym equipment behind the banners that we produced, and we put our own dance floor in there, and that's where Shoom began.
Yes, so in terms of the logistics behind getting that together, had you, obviously you've been to Ibiza, you've heard Alfredo weave his magical Balearic beat spell. Was it a case of, okay, I've got to come back and get all of these records that I've heard? Or was it a case of, I understand the vibe of Amnesia and I want to bring that home and set up Shoom? Like, what was the kind of musical policy and the creation behind that?
Well, the kind of indie stuff, I wasn't really into the indie music scene. So that was all really, you know, that sound was new to me, and I think to the others as well. So all of those kind of records, like Front 242 and The Residents, and all of those tracks were out of the kind of industrial sound and indie music, Thrashing Doves. And Alfredo played a lot of records that totally inspired us, and we came back and found them and started playing them also. Same as what Larry Levan did at the garage. He'd play records and people would go and find the records, and then they'd start playing those records as well. So he was a figurehead, Alfredo, and he was greatly influential to a whole generation of DJs and clubbers. Still a great DJ today. He's a great friend, and he was the benchmark, really. And I hadn't heard a DJ play like that. You know, had lots of DJ favorites, but I'd never heard Larry Levan or Frankie or any of the Chicago DJs before I went to Ibiza. So it was an eye opener, and that really inspired us greatly. I emulated the way he played music. It gave me an influence into playing music more choppy and mixing it up with all different sounds. So a new sound, the Balearic sound, which is quite misunderstood as well back then, it was represented, and it became a scene. It was part of the early acid house scene.
Yeah, and so when you set up Shoom and those first kind of parties, can you remember, did you think it was going to grow into what it eventually did? Did you think this is something that people would still be talking about, you know, 30 years later? Or was it just, I want to have some fun and, you know, bring this music to a wider audience?
It was an incredible time, and it's hard to describe. It was a very, very extraordinary time. It was unique. It was also new, also fresh. It brought so many different people together. It created unity. We created unity. It was a collective consciousness that swept through the UK and across the world, for that matter, particularly here in Europe. And a scene was born, a movement came out of that. But it was apolitical. It was all about fun. It was all about, we created a DIY culture. It was a counterculture. And it created a lot of opportunity, which is everything that Margaret Thatcher was doing at that time. But then also there was a lot of economic disparity, just as there is in today's society in Britain. And we just did our own thing. We did our own thing. It wasn't political. And a lot of careers began, a lot of friendships, lifelong friendships, marriages, kids came out of that scene. It was an amazing time for a couple of years. It really did bring everybody together. It just smashed everything down. Every taboo you can think of was just tossed aside. And we were having the time of our lives. We were so carefree and free at the same time. There was such a level of freedom. This is before the big, you know, kind of money driven raves that came out of this. But that couple of years, it was, you know, even some of those raves, they weren't solely driven by money. It became that way later. But it was just a life. It was a life changing time for so many people.
What are your indelible memories from the Schoon parties over the years? What kind of stands out to you as the most memorable tunes or people or nights that you had in there?
Oh, have you got 3 weeks? it's to encapsulate that down into, you know, just one or two points is quite difficult. But it was about the energy in the club, because it was people from all walks of life, and that was the magic of it all. It was a small room, 300 people, you know, and I guess, like, you know, the Cavern when the Beatles began, there was a feeling going on there. The Richmond Hotel where the Rolling Stones began, and all of these movements have, you know, kind of core small venues, where, and punk as well, like the Vortex and the 100 Club. Well, that's what Schoon was about. Schoon was, it was the new punk rock in a sense. It was just, you know, it was just, everyone just got on and did their own thing. But every night became like a religious experience for a lot of people. They would just look so much forward to Saturday night, and then Saturday would come along and be filled with anticipation and excitement. Get down into that basement and then just let off so much steam and just lose themselves in music. The energy in the room in Schoon was always electrifying. It really was a magical energy, and that was a feeling of collective consciousness and people's energy together, and the energy of the room and the music and my energy transferring that to the dance floor and reciprocated energy. And I was on fire because I'd found a crowd and a venue to play my music and be appreciated as a DJ playing that music. That was always my dream, and my dream had come true, and I was on cloud nine.
And just kind of during that period as well, I mean, Schoon was one of the first ones, but then kind of there were other parties kind of popping up as well at that time. Did you ever see yourself kind of in competition with them, or was it all part of, you were all part of one scene, kind of supporting each other and, you know, pushing your own sounds?
Yeah, it did begin that way. There was, but yeah, it certainly did. And Schoon wasn't competing with anybody. We were our own crowd of people. We're all part of the same scene, but, you know, kind of there was no competition. We weren't competing against another club. You had Future with Paul Oakenfold, but later became Bigger Spectrum, a much bigger club. Mm-hmm. You had Black Market from René Gelston at the WAG. You had Love at the WAG, which followed Black Market. Hedonism was a great warehouse party in Wembley, a very underground warehouse party. You had Clink Street, but I mean there were a little bit of rivalry with some people, but they clearly didn't get the actual ethos and feeling of the scene. But it was a minority, really. Really was. Everyone was just together. It was like you'd see someone in, you know, kind of baggy clothes or fluoro clothes and smiley t-shirts, and you knew they were part of your tribe. It had a look, the whole scene, you know, just like the 60s did, with mods and hippies and rockers and punks. You know, there was an identity. There was a fashion around it as well. So people identified with their fellow tribe members.
And did you, what was it like when you went back out to Ibiza, I suppose, and did you explain to Alfredo the inspiration he had given you? How did that happen? And were you still continuing to visit Ibiza kind of regularly after Schoon had been set
up? It was bloody marvellous. All joking aside, in 87, I didn't know Alfredo. I said hello to him, but I didn't really have a conversation with him. Paul knew him more, because Paul was a record plugger at Rush Release, which was a leading promo company. So Paul was more close with him initially, because I think he'd been servicing, he started servicing vinyl to Alfredo. And then him and Nicky went there on a second visit in 87. But everything really took off in about January, February 88. It really did start to gather massive momentum in that early part of 88, which then became the Summer of Love. So the opening of Amnesia that year was incredible. It really was. And we were all there for that. A lot of the Schoon crowd were there. Everyone was there. It really was an incredible, I think that was in June. It may have been in June, or yeah, I think it was in early June. That was the opening of Amnesia.
OK. Okay.
And everyone talks about that party and how incredible that was, because we've been building up. We've taken a lot of inspiration from Ibiza and sprinkled all that Ibiza magic into London without the kind of sunshine and the palm trees and the open air. So we just we adapted it into the London model. And when we got out there the following summer, it was the summer of love. And the scene had then developed in that summer. It was everywhere. It was all over the newspapers. The newspapers were sensationalising it, and lock up your daughters and all this, and lock up your children, and Ecstasy Airport, and all of these like scandalous headlines, and trying to single people out. But what they actually did was, like, kids were at work during the week. And you know, they'd read the newspaper and see it on Monday morning. They'd see all these like rebellious people at raves and what have you, and parties and stuff. And the media fueled it. It's like, you know, don't go there, stay away. You know, this is it, the work of the devil. But they actually sensationalized it to a degree that, you know, John, who was working on a building site and hating his job, just like, I'm having some of this. went out on the weekend and like partied hard. And then, like a lot of those people, they left their jobs. A lot of people did leave their jobs, because they had an opportunity to do something else in an industry that they wanted to be part of. We created our own industry. The industry we know today was really born out of that time. And a lot of people have made a lot of money from it.
Yeah, like you mentioned, like John on the building site. I mean, the worst thing you can say to someone of that age is, you know, it's dangerous, you shouldn't be doing this, you shouldn't go there. And that's, you know, just the red rag to the bull, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And maybe they did it intentionally, but it was, you know, kind of, where are your children, you know, at the weekend? Are they at these raves and unlicensed events and parties? But, you know, it just, like, it was that kind of rebellious nature. And the pubs started to empty out. People didn't want to go to the pub. They wanted to get out there and dance with thousands of other people, whether it was in, you know, kind of the early clubs or out in fields in raves. And that was it. The scene was born. Mm-hmm. And it did spread through this country like wildfire. You know, the raves in Blackburn and everywhere, and Manchester had the Hacienda, so, and Nottingham with the Garage. Everything just all came together. Scotland with Street Rave. Incredible time and an incredible feeling within youth culture. We changed so much.
And did you realise at that time that you'd been part of the spark that set that fire ablaze? Were you kind of proud at that time, or was it just something that was just happening?
No, it wasn't something that just happening. Shume was all about peace, love, unity, and doing your own thing and coming together. And the spirit of my own zest for life, and the energy that I was projecting into Shume, the optimism was infectious, and a lot of it came out of that club. And it was, you know, in Amnesia, it was a little bit more pretentious, I'd say, but there was such a mix of people that, you know, there was something happening, and people were tuned into it. And let's look back to it. The Berlin Wall was falling, and apartheid was crumbling. So all these things combined, it was like, hey, the world's changing and we are changing the world, you know. And we really did believe that we were changing the world, and we were within our own community and our own culture. And we did. We changed it.
The summer of love, 88, the Berlin Wall coming down in 89. It's the start of a new decade into the 90s. And people kind of look back towards the 90s now, and they kind of liken that to the 60s. It's almost the last massive youth movement that we've seen.
Yeah, I think the late 80s were more akin to the 60s, because there was the whole unity and togetherness, collective consciousness. The 90s became the party decade, with the whole foundations for the scene was set over 88, 89 and early 90. And then that whole decade that followed was just tremendous, incredible. There was one long party for everyone. It was, you know, the decade, the 90s decade was a party decade until the millennium came along and changed everything. But, you know, it was a great period for music, for fashion, for art, for the sales of records, for the sales of compilation CDs, for artists, for producers, for everybody that was part of this scene. You know, we'd created this new arm of the music industry. And compilation albums would sell 1 million copies, which is, you know, leading artists, leading pop or rock artists kind of territory of sales. But the compilation albums came out of the early mixtape business, where people would just record sets, and then there'd be distributors and they'd sell them for a fiver each at Camden Market and Notting Hill, Ladbroke Grove, and all over the country for that matter. People would be selling like bootleg tapes, and that's how that industry began, the compilation side, compilation market began. Out of those early bootleg tapes.
Yeah, to have some of those tapes now, or to have something even to play them on. When I discover a tape in my house now, I've got nothing to play it on.
Well, that's exactly it. And I need to get a new cassette deck because I've got hundreds of tapes here that I need to copy over. Yeah, and I'm going to get them up on my Mixcloud page, on the Mixcloud Select site. Part of the page. So a lot of work's going to go into the copying of them. And there's a huge library of rare tapes. There is an original Shume recording from Shume on the Farm that's up on my Mixcloud page. I think that's got 8,000 or 10,000 listens, which is pretty good.
Amazing.
In terms of Mixcloud stats. So that's my aim with a lot of these rare sets that haven't been heard from back in the the Summer of Love time through the 90s up to the present.
How exciting! Yeah, I mean to be able to have that history in that back catalogue and you've got it, and just to be able to kind of share that now. This is stuff that, like you say, before CDs and compilation albums, these things were bootleg tapes and they've all perished and all disappeared in the mists of time. It's great you can get them together and put them up digitally.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, have you listened to any of them back, and are you proud of every single thing, or is there anything that makes you kind of cringe or anything like that?
It's your one or two, but it's just like, kind of get a bit nostalgic when I have listened to some of them, and it just takes you right back in that moment of where you were and when that was, and kind of that's the magic of it. And I'm a collector. I collect, I've hoarded cassettes and vinyl and memorabilia, books. I like to collect things. I think that comes from childhood, collecting stamps and things, and kind of cars and football cards and what have you, and books and stuff and records, and it just stays with you, doesn't it? I've tried to encourage my son to collect things, but he doesn't seem that interested. But it's generation now. He's not that bothered. You collect things, they become more valuable over time, and I was trying to get this message across to him. And it's treasure. It's not treasure to everybody.
No, it's a much more disposable kind of culture now, really, isn't it?
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, you mentioned so the 90s kind of being a like party decade, and like you obviously participated in that with your Love Groove dance party on BBC Radio 1, moving from Kiss. Was it 94 that you moved over from Kiss?
Yeah, I think it was about 94. Well, I was on Kiss FM when it became a legal station.
Yeah.
I held a Saturday night show there. I started on Kiss FM as a late night Tuesday night, Wednesday morning show at 2 in the morning. And then I'd get the night bus home, sleep for an hour, and then go on to work at 7:30 in the morning.
Oh, my God.
But, hey, that's how much I wanted to be a radio DJ. So, it was like, you know, it was only Tuesday night, but it was a foot in the door. And it served me well. And I thank Gordon Mack from Kiss FM, and he's now the director of My Soul Radio. I'm forever grateful for Gordon recognising that talent. And that's Gordon is great at recognising talent and giving them a platform. And, you know, we celebrate that because, he's a great personality and a great man and has really platformed so many of the DJ and radio legends and stars that we know today. Many of them have come through Gordon Mack's radio stations.
And so you started on Kiss when it was an illegal station as well. So what was that like? Were there any really sketchy moments? Did you feel like you were completely anti-establishment and you were locked up in a tower block somewhere broadcasting, or how was that?
No, it wasn't. Kiss was really, it wasn't one of the bandit pirate stations. There were a few about. There were two or three radio stations at that time, and there was no output apart from a couple of dance shows on the BBC, one on the BBC with Jeff Young and Robbie Vincent and Greg Edwards on Capital. So there wasn't much in terms of dance music output. So the pirate radio, it expanded through that period because that's what people wanted to listen to on the radio. And Kiss was not anti-establishment, that's for sure, because Kiss ran their station in a very responsible way. You know, they wouldn't go breaking into somewhere and then, you know, kind of be at war with other pirate stations, which did go on at the time. And there was the odd occasion where, oh, the DTI are going to raid the station. But they'd actually tip Kiss off to say, we're going to take you off air. So they would never, kind of arrest any DJs, which did happen at the time. There was a real cat and mouse thing going on. But Gordon ran a responsible station with Tosca Jackson, and it was off air now and then when they'd remove the aerial from high points in London. The aerials would all be removed, and then the station would go off air for a little bit, and then get some more money together and put another aerial up. So it was, that was the kind of the game that was going on at the time with the DTI at the time, and it was all part of the fun of it. You know, there was. You know, it was rebellious, and it was a platform for great music, and that was what it was all about.
Yeah, I mean, it's a massive thing to actually get the license, and you know, to, like you said, all of the talent that was pooled within Kiss at that time and has gone through Kiss to give a platform to all of that talent is amazing. You look at, you know, you do some research on the station even before it became legal, the laundry list of well-known names that have all participated in that success. It's incredible.
Oh, it is, yeah. And there's MBEs four former DJs of Kiss have got MBEs. Yeah. Kiss was a pirate for many years, and then it had to come off of the airwaves for 1 year before it could broadcast on a legal FM bandwidth, a year was taken out. So all the DJs agreed not to go to any other radio stations and take a year off of the radio while they prepared everything and got all of the everything in place, ready to go live and legal.
That shows a lot of faith as well in the station, that you would all make that choice as well, not to go elsewhere while that 12-month period went on.
Yeah, and everyone wanted to be on the radio playing music, but everybody was loyal to Kiss and to Gordon, and that's what happened. So when Kiss came back on the air, everybody was still there that had been there previously under the pirate flag.
Yeah, and when you eventually did make that move over to BBC Radio 1, the BBC, it's this huge national, well-respected organ. Did you feel that this was the establishment giving approval for this sound, this dance music sound that might not have had much coverage. Like you said before, there were only a couple of dance shows or whatever before. Did you feel like this was the approval and you were the figurehead of that?
Well, they didn't like, the BBC didn't like Acid House, that's for sure, and the rave scene. they were all a part of the sensationalism as well at that time, you know. Banning records and what have you, but it just made it more popular, didn't it? So, yeah, it was a strange one because I was so loyal to Kiss and I had to leave within a couple of weeks and I wasn't comfortable with that. I really wasn't. I had a meeting with Radio 1 and I wasn't that comfortable with moving so abruptly rather than 3 or 4 months, but it was an opportunity. And my wife, stroke manager at the time, Jenny, said, you know, this is a natural progression because Kiss was only limited to London then.
Yeah.
But going from London radio show to national was a little bit daunting to begin, I had to say. You know, you wasn't just talking to, you know, your old core audience in London. You're now talking to the whole country. So it took a bit of time to adjust. But yeah, I still to this day, you know, I'm sorry I had to leave Kiss in such an abrupt way, and I think, you know, it upset Gordon at the time, but we're all right now. But it wasn't through disloyalty, it was just about an opportunity with Radio 1 that Matthew Bannister had changed the station's output and wanted a station that was more like Kiss, that was more up to date, because it was too old hat before they poached me, Judge Jules, Giles Peterson and Tim Westwood, and then changes the face of Radio 1 on the weekend.
Yes, crazy. You just list off those names and, yeah, to poach all of those guys to change that station sound. Imitation is just a serious form of flattery.
Well, exactly. But what it also did, it really, that period in the 90s, it boomed time. And the output of music going national as well, rather than regional radio stations, and the output of that over the weekend, it really helped the sales of compilation CDs, the sales of records, producers, record labels, everything that, you know, part of the industry was helped by the platform of radio. So many great records were broken on the BBC nationally. But I think if there wasn't that output on the BBC at the time, those records may not have been as huge as what they were, even though they were huge in clubs. The radio backed that up to another audience as well. Mm-hmm. And people were buying music, whether they went to a club or not, they were buying music throughout the 90s. It was a great time for the sales of music.
Yeah, and it was even better for Ibiza in a way that that BBC dance music project then went over to start doing the kind of weekenders on the island. And did that realization suddenly think like, wow, this is, you know, this is down to me almost in a way? Did that feeling come across?
Yeah, in a sense, I was never comfortable with those Radio 1 weekenders, I had to say. It felt a bit like the Radio 1 roadshow that I'd been to as a kid in like Bognor Regis with like their star leading DJs. I think that's what kind of got in the way with me at times. I was just like, God, this is a bit like the Radio 1 roadshow in like kind of Bognor.
more palm actually, trees, you know, and a lot of
well, a lot of, yeah, no, exactly. But a lot of people loved it. And the first one I did behind closed doors. Just didn't want to stand in front of the audience, like, you know, kind of on the mic. I was all right in the radio studio, but I just didn't fancy standing there and being the compere, you know. And it took a bit of time to get used to that. So eventually I was kind of like standing in front of the audience. But I think for me, one of them was when we did Pasha. And we were scheduled to do the roof in Pasha, and then it got cancelled, and we had to drive at top speed over to Cafe Mambo, where there was like about 88,000 people on the beach. No, exaggerating. I don't know. The beach was just a sea of people. It's like, God, how many people are on this beach? Just looking out, it was, again, it was like, oh my gosh, it's like incredible in that sense. But, you know, it was just huge. And I remember that night as well, because Roger Sanchez was playing before me and Pav was playing on percussion. And I was actually stressed out because my show had been pulled in Pasha. So last minute, I got to get over there. So I haven't had any time to set up, just straight in, you know, kind of on the decks presenting a radio show to thousands of people on the beach. That was hard work. I think that was one of the, that was a very difficult show, I have to say, because of the stress of the other show being pulled.
And do nerves and stress still kind of play a part when you're playing live now, or are you just a complete seasoned professional and it's just all very easy?
Sometimes stress is unavoidable, but let's just say there's a technical glitch when you're halfway through a set. You can't get stressed out about it. It's something I've learned over the years. I mean, younger years might have had a few stressful moments, but it's something you like learn to adapt with, and you just keep your cool. It might be a few seconds or it could be a couple of minutes, but keep your cool and you know that the music will be restored. So, you know, I just stay calm in those situations, you know, kind of pick up a drink, look through the playlist at what's being played, what I can play next, or back on the music. Stress associated with DJing comes from travel. That can put a lot of pressure on, particularly when flights are late and or delayed and so on. But getting nervous before an event, some events, yeah, but generally, you know, it's, I think everyone has a little bit of you know, kind of butterflies and kind of anticipation. It's natural, but I don't get like kind of give me a tranquilizer to calm my nerves. I played at Shoom in Brixton. We did a very large event there, Within the City Live, when was that? That was in November 2019. It was an incredible party, sold out. But I didn't want to go out into the audience because lots of friends and everything, and it can kind of get overwhelming. So I just went and sat in the dressing room upstairs for about 90 minutes, even though I was hosting the event, because I wanted to just solely center my energy, not have any distractions, just sit in a quiet place before I went out and played that set. And I played a really, really great set. You know, as soon as it was showtime, ready to go down and get on the stage, and it's a big venue there, just get on and do it. But I needed that time upstairs, just be on my own, be removed from everything. And then after, then I was mixing with everyone and went out and, you know, kind of had a dance and said hello to friends and stuff and was talking to people. But before a set, I try to avoid that as much as possible. Yeah. And I think a lot of DJs do, you know, it's just, and the same as musicians, you know. You don't want to be having like a party around you when you're going out there to provide the soundtrack to that. That's just my own point of view and how I have learned to just produce better sets and be totally calm and focused on the set at hand.
Yeah, I mean, the number of DJs we've spoken to on this series so far, a common theme is a travel aspect and just, you know, getting you down. Essentially, you are working nights, traveling a lot, and it can kind of grind you down in that sense. You know, you have a huge party and the set's great, but then afterwards, you know, almost sometimes immediately afterwards, you could be on a flight elsewhere. And, you know, that kind of come down aspect, it's about managing that and being mindful. And if you've got a process for that, I think it's very important.
Well, I think that also comes with experience as well, because through the 90s, you know, I'd go and do my sets and then I'd go and party all day. Most people did. And lots of people partied while they were actually playing sets, but that wasn't really my kind of style. But the last many, many years, it's, let's say I'm playing in Newcastle. I'd be on a train on Sunday morning out of Newcastle at 8:30 and I may have finished at 3 or 4 in the morning. So I'll have a couple of hours sleep, get on the train, head back, because I like to spend Sunday as a day of rest, actually, you know, kind of switching off from everything and having a few hours of respite. But I wouldn't give that up for the world. I've traveled everywhere and continue to travel, and I'm really missing that right now, like most people. But I don't get stressed out about the travel anymore. I went through periods of that in the 90s, but I don't anymore. I'm just, you know, I'm very grateful if I get booked, you know, to play in New York or Australia, wherever it may be, or Asia. I'm immensely grateful that 30 odd years I'm here, still appreciated and still doing what I love, and that passion for music. And that's not to be taken for granted for 1 minute, because when it is taken away, and I stepped away for 2 years, you never know what it's got, what you've got until it's gone. That you know, kind of that old saying. And that is so true. It really is so true. So when I hear DJs moaning about, like, oh, well, yeah, you know, kind of I had to do this and I had to do that. Yeah, well, cut the schedule back a bit. you know, that's down with the kind of the agents, and it's your choice at the end of the day. If you're taking 6 gigs back to back, yeah, the money's great and everything, but it does take its toll. But you know, kind of, there's no point moaning about it. It's just, you know, just cut back what you're doing. It's not going to go away. You're good at what you do, and you know, it's not like you're here today and gone tomorrow. I think that's the fear with a lot of people as well. But right now, we're all missing this industry, and we're going out clubbing, celebrating life, playing music, missing it terribly.
Yeah, and you know, we can talk about the, we're obviously kind of in the lockdown period right now. It's kind of coming towards the end, but you know, businesses are opening up, but things like nightclubs and that nighttime industry, they're still closed. And you know, you've got all of the, not only the DJs, not only the clubs and the festivals, but everything that's kind of in a domino effect in and around all of those events. And
absolutely,
yeah, yeah, I mean, you know, and the government have been quite, they haven't really been overt in what they're going to be doing with funding specifically about that sector of the economy. And you've been doing some great work with Let Us Dance and Forgotten Limited. You know, I just want to get your feelings on how important it is. Do you think that, you know, these things survived after this period?
Well, and Save Nightlife, I campaign for also, and it's important to campaign because we've slipped through the cracks. This everything closed down in March, and it's been really challenging for many, many people. You know, we don't have the advantage of being home, getting on with DIY, drinking, you know, kind of beer and having barbecues in the garden, and like having a bit of an extended break and catching up on all this thing. You know, it's been bloody tough for a lot of people in this industry and the supporting industries in the nighttime economy. And the recent arts and culture funding package is not incorporating the nightclub sector and the festival sector, which is £66 billion contribution to the UK economy annually. And 3 million people employed. And right now, many people are unemployed, including myself right now. And that's why I rigorously campaign for these campaigns, because we don't have any meaningful support. We do not have an end date in sight, which is very, very unsettling and uncertain for so many people and so many businesses that have been built up over years. And not turning huge profits, but, you know, kind of, you know, people's passion and their lives that have gone into businesses and venues and festivals and, you know, the investment they make year on year to business and for people to enjoy entertainment and going out and dancing and listening to music. You know, all of these things considered, and bars and restaurants that have music in, and whether that be live music or DJs, all of these things, you know, we can't dance at the moment. It's ludicrous. This like block on dancing, what is that all about?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, there are restrictions. There's health and safety compliance. But come on, you know, we all need to dance. It's important to dance to release those positive, good endorphins. It's a primal need of most human beings, whatever age you are, to dance. And we are missing that. And it's causing a lot of anxiety for people. Mental health statistics are rising. It's a challenge day to day for a lot of people. And it, you know, there's this other thing. Oh, we'll retrain for something else. Well, we don't want to retrain for something else, which is also not really an option, because retraining can take months as well. And there's no guarantee of work. So yeah, we have built up an industry here that is world renowned and has been exported across the globe. And we produce so many stars and new talent from this country, and that has to be preserved and supported. The way that the arts and the opera and the theatre is being supported, or there's proposals for grassroots venues, have got to be supported. Every town needs a grassroots venue for live music and for DJs and for nightclubs. It's very, very important. It's part of the fabric of society. And it's becoming a battle right now. And people have to become aware that if there isn't any support, then your local club or your local live music venue could be gone. That we're already seeing venues closing, and it's incredibly sad that people have put blood, sweat and tears into businesses, and they've had to close. There were two venues which closed in Manchester in the past week, and a venue in Hull. There are venues in London, all over the country. And this has got to be stopped. It's, you know, that we have to get support for our industry. And anybody who likes going out listening to live music or dancing to DJs, you've got to support these campaigns as well. Because, you know, your entertainment and your leisure time is going to be impacted. And your local club, your local place where you see bands, it very well could not be there if there is no affirmative government support and action that is put in place with immediate effect. It's a very precarious position the industry is in right now. Mm. And it's important that we support the campaigns. Forgotten Limited is for freelancers in the creative industries, in across the creative industries, and small limited company directors who do not qualify for any meaningful government support, cannot get bounce back loans. They're not in the furlough position. So those people are the backbone of the creative industries and the music industry. The nighttime economy is the campaign for the nighttime economy and festivals, clubs, theatre, hospitality, Save Nightlife. It's a very important campaign also. And a new campaign has been launched on the 26th of July, which is called Let Us Dance. And this can be found on the ntia.co.uk website. And this needs support across the whole of the industry, from the established artists and seasoned clubbers to the new generation, to the new talent, to new venue owners, to existing venue. Everybody who works in this industry needs to support this campaign, the Let Us Dance campaign. It's hashtag Let Us Dance. Please get involved. Write to your MP. It's very important that you write to your local MP. There's a letter template. You don't have to write your own letter. It's on the site at NTIA. It takes 2 minutes to send that to your MP. The more letters that go through to MPs, the more pressure is put upon the MPs, then that will be discussed in Parliament. And we need to apply that pressure right now, because our industry is in grave danger and our scene of not returning to what it ever was. And we have spent years of passion building up this incredible music scene that we have here in the UK. And please support those campaigns. Very, very, very important.
Amazing. Amazing call to arms. I love it. And yeah, we'll definitely be promoting all of those things on our Instagram feed and supporting that as well, and making sure that our audience are aware of all of that. No problem. And I mean, during this period, like some of that, you know, businesses have kind of tried to pivot a little and maybe been doing things, moving things online, and people are still being having access to kind of DJs and music. And, you know, I'm thinking of Defected Virtual Festival and those types of things. What are your thoughts on kind of doing things virtually? Have you enjoyed anything that you've done, or is it just a means to an end and just to keep people dancing in their living rooms?
Well, I wasn't able to contribute to any live streams when it was in the fall quarantining. I don't like to use that other word. when we couldn't go out anywhere, and when it was very restrictive. So I have done a couple of live streams, and yeah, they were okay. One was a transatlantic age thing as well. I was playing a set, and a 15-year-old hip-hop DJ from Atlanta was playing the set on the same live stream, which is really cool because it brought a lot of people together from all walks and ages of life, you know, from the US and from the UK as well. People were on a Zoom live stream, so that was cool. But the future isn't with live streaming. Yes, it's part of it. We need to get back out, and we need to be able to go out and enjoy concerts and festivals and club nights again. That is the essence of it all. Everyone's tried to adapt somehow, some way. Defected are a leading company, so you know they have a massive fan base. They have a massive, massive streaming fan base as well. So you know, as a company and the records they release, they're a very strong company. But not all companies are like Defected, and don't have that massive fan base that they have. So they've done a lot of good things for charity, and a lot of the live streams have. But at the end of the day, also, people do need to make a living. Mm. People who are on Universal Credit, for example, £410 a month, that doesn't even pay people's bills. So people have got in the industry have got to start making a living. Village Underground, for example, in London, leading London club in Shoreditch, they've adapted and they've turned the club in for, as a temporary measure, into a bicycle storage. It's just adapting to get some revenues to help the overheads and the cost of the building. Yeah. And hopefully that club will reopen and get back to its former glory. But yeah, it's just an example of how people have had to adapt. And I just pray that we do not lose all these great clubs that that we support, and they, you know, they support us as DJs, as clubbers. They're places, you know, where we go out clubbing, dancing, and having a great time and meeting new friends. They've got to be supported. So ways of adapting. I've created a YouTube channel which I've been working on over this this period of being out of the music scene as such, and we have a series of interviews with very interesting people under the YouTube title Surviving 2020. And the first interview is with Michael Kill of the Nighttime Industries Association this week, along with Georgina Broadhurst from Forgotten Limited. And those interviews will be live under Surviving 2020. I've also put a series of Love Groove Dance Party, LGDP radio podcasts together during this quarantining. And so there's five episodes of that that are on Mixcloud. I'll be producing a new show this weekend. And it's good to be back doing a radio show. It really is.
Well, that was your first love, wasn't it, really?
It's brought a lot of pleasure to people as well. I've had some great feedback, particularly when everyone could not go out anywhere and was just contained to their homes. It's kept a lot of people company, and that's the power of radio. Mm-hmm. The live stream is more visual, but with radio, there's a lot more with the imagination of the listener. What does the radio presenter look like? Where are they broadcasting from? All these things combined, you know, and you're talking one-to-one. Mm-hmm. And that's the perception that I'm listening to this radio show, and actually, you know, I'm having a, you know, a couple of hours with this person, this DJ or whatever DJ that is. It's just me and him or her. Mm-hmm. And that's the imaginative side of radio, which is really important.
So the final question that we always ask all of our guests is, we are House Culture, and you are one of the founding fathers, the originators of this house music scene and this whole culture within the UK and the world that has been created. You've played a huge part in that. What does the scene mean to you personally, and what has it brought you in your life?
Well, it's brought me a lot of joy and a lot of other people as well. I just love playing music and finding new music and playing that. I play classics events as well, but I have to say that new music is where I my real passion is, and that's what I continue to do, just playing good new music, celebrating life on the dance floor or behind the decks. I like to dance still. I don't get the opportunity as much as I used to go out and get on the floor. But I still get out there and have a dance as well. It's important. Mm-hmm. And to listen to other people playing. But I'm eternally proud that in the whole sequence of the events of the development of house music and the electronic music scene, the role that I played back then in the inception years here in the UK. And today I'm equally as passionate about the music and the scene, and long may that continue.
Perfect. That's the great place to end on, I think.
Yeah, well, I've enjoyed being with you. It's been a great interview, and love the questions. And I think you've got the best out of me this morning.
House Culture.
How awesome was that? One of the originators of house music in the UK and the world, right here on the House Culture Podcast. I want to personally thank Danny for not only taking part, but for putting up with my incessant badgering for an interview. We got there in the end. Not even a worldwide pandemic was going to stop us. And I hope you enjoyed listening and learning about Mr. Rampling's journey through the dance music scene. You also heard Danny mention Gordon Mack, the founder of Kiss FM, when he was talking about his early days on pirate radio. If you want to hear Gordon's story about the creation of that particular brand, you can listen to our interview with the man himself in our first series of podcasts. It's also not often we get these released so quickly. This one was only recorded the other week. However, as you heard, there is some urgent business for us all to attend to in terms of helping out artists, venues, staff and employees. If you're listening to this podcast, you most definitely participate in activities that are going to be directly affected by the pandemic. And we all need to take immediate action in order for these venues and DJs to still be there for us once this is all over. Like Danny said, follow the hashtag LetUsDance, go to the Nighttime Industries Association website at ntia.co.uk for more info, and write to your local MP asking them to support the nighttime economy. Without it, dance floors will die. But if you want to provide some tunage for your own private dance floor, you can check out our playlist on Spotify. Just search for House Culture Perfect Playlist, and there you'll find a whole smorgasbord of sounds chosen by all of our podcast guests that cover every aspect of dance music. Now, we didn't get time in our chat to go through Danny's submissions. However, I have them here, and he has chosen for his catalyst, Let the Music Use You by the Night Writers, an epic Frankie Knuckles production that was also a catalyst for Smokin' Joe. His floor filler is the stunning Kolch remix of Frankie Knuckles' Your Love, featuring the vocals of Jamie Principle and the instrumentation of the Heritage Orchestra, conducted by Jules Buckley. His Sunsetter is his production alongside Balearic legend Phil Myson's alter ego Cantoma. It's called Claudio's Theme, and it's an absolute stunner. If you haven't heard any of Phil Myson's Cantoma stuff, get yourself down that rabbit hole ASAP. Danny's Tearjerker is a track that has also been favourited by Tall Paul. It's another production from the godfather of house music, Frankie Knuckles. It's his track, The Whistle Song. And for his final track, the one Danny wants to send you all home humming, is the brutally beautiful Alberto Ruiz 80 Monster remix of Solstice by Monica Cruz meets Pig and Dan. Once you've tucked into all of those tunes, please help support the House Culture Podcast by loving, liking, tweeting, sharing, and rating or reviewing us on Apple. This last bit is really important. It does make a difference. If you say something really nice, we'll give you a mention on the next episode. Which is why this time around, I'm giving a shout out to the person who reviewed us on Apple. It goes by the name of The Gloon. I just listened to our interview with Norman Cook. Thought it was a great natural conversation with some great insights into why Norman became such an icon. Thanks for taking the time to put that in writing to us, and I hope you're enjoying listening to the other icons within our back catalogue of episodes, including this one. And finally, don't forget, if you want to get in touch with me, Matt Rouse, you can contact me directly on Instagram at DJ Matt Rouse. Thanks for listening, stay safe, and see you next time.
House Culture.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.